You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. HuntStand is the most popular and functional mobile hunting app on the market. With a variety of base maps to choose from, satellite imagery that is updated every month, the ability to check the weather, know property information, and even catalog your trail cam pics, HuntStand even gives you the ability to import pins and location markers from other mobile apps. Visit HuntStand.com or download wherever you download your apps. Enter discount code SN20 at checkout for 20% off.
This is the Missouri Woods and Water Podcast with your host, Andy, Micah, and Nate.
You're doing that shit on purpose. He emphasized this.
I don't understand the problem.
He's not lying.
Who's not lying?
Andy's not, because it is. That's what this is.
We want to welcome them to
welcome to it, but this is it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it.
You get what you get.
You dumbasses are never going to get it right. So.
But what's right? See, here we were just having this conversation of what is right.
Yeah, and it's only right if it's his. If it's Nate's. If it has anything to do with what we want, no. This is the way it goes. This is more organized. Yeah. This is more right.
It's only more right because I'm the one doing it. Well, not this, but that and others.
Well, welcome to it.
Yeah. Welcome to it. Welcome to the shit show, folks.
Well, today, guys, we have a good one for you, as usual.
That I'll agree with. Got a good one today, folks.
Yep. Today we have our friends over at Maven Optics to come on and talk a little bit of binocular stuff, but our main topic is rifle scopes.
We talked a little bit about Maven, rifle scopes. Yeah. You know, who they are, where they came from, and then he breaks down a rifle scope pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he breaks the shit out of it right there in front of us.
Yeah, no, he does a really good job explaining things. I mean, just some.
Oh, we got it. It just wasn't funny.
Yeah, you're just not.
Whatever. We do want to give a little, not a teaser, because this is going to come out
it's
over, actually. But if you have not yet, we have a pre-order.
If you haven't heard about it.
I haven't heard about it.
We have an online store.
Pre-order online store that we've opened up for our listeners who keep asking for apparel and
for ourselves who want stuff.
So we've got that. We've got some hats, some shirts, and some hoodies. Yep. Different colors for each. If you don't like the colors or there's a color that isn't available, I would say blame Micah, but that's just me.
I didn't want to get too complicated with too many colors at first.
Micah just took it like
a man. We're going with the KISS method.
Yeah. Keep it simple, stupid. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
But to order something, hop on our Instagram or our Facebook page, and we're gonna try to do a good job of posting.
We'll have a link in the link tree
where you link it,
or it's linked to the link.
Tag on this, and then tag on that, and then yeah. But no, go ahead. Explain what you
check out our link tree. It's right at the very top, and it'll take you to the page. I'll also post stories and whatever else with the link.
We're just kind of going to try to get this started. And so for right now, it's going to be a store. It's kind of a
two-week store, right?
A two-week store, pre-order, get everything sent out to you. If it goes well, if we have good support for it, there's a chance we could open up a kind of permanent store.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you guys want it, we'll do it, but you got to do your part too.
Yeah.
So
check it out. Give some feedback on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you had any problems, obviously, but you'll go in there, order, and then once the pre-order is done, then that's when stuff will get shipped out or whatever.
Right. Yes.
This is new for us too, so I have no idea how any of that shit works.
Yeah, but yeah, we're trying dipping
more
our
than
toes
our,
in.
Our hat options that we're shipping out of Nate's basement. So
yeah, this makes it a little easier on us once we get the ball rolling. So.
We,
you. But let's get into some of our sponsors for today.
Today's show, we got. Let's do it a little different order. Habitat Works.
Yep.
Our buddy Dustin.
Yep. Give Dustin a holler.
We are, you know, third week of May at this point.
Give him a holler. Clean out your holler.
Loser.
Okay.
That was a good one.
I didn't. No. No.
No? Okay.
Not you, Dustin. Andy. Andy is the loser. But give Dustin a call. 816-752-7390. Or shoot him an email. HabitatWorksLLC@gmail.com. Mention us when you call. You get 15% off any service. He does it all. Timber stand improvement, forestry mulching.
Fire burning.
It's third week of May now, so probably no more burning going on.
No, everything's pretty green at this point, especially when this comes out. It's going to be green. So,
yep. So give him a call. Huntworth Gear. Micah, you going to say your normal thing?
It's awesome.
No?
I love it. What do I normally say?
What's he say? Like, couldn't be any happier.
We couldn't be happier with those guys.
Well, I mean, it's every the truth. Week. It's the truth.
Couldn't be any happier.
No.
He isn't wrong.
It's good stuff.
Yeah. It's great stuff, and, you know, we're happy to, you know, use their stuff. And
you and I, here in a few weeks, are going to be using it at the end of May to go hunt some coyotes up there.
Yep. Yeah, we're going to do our now annual
coyote. This is our second annual.
Yeah, coyote birthday hunt, birthday coyote hunt, however you want to say that. So, because me and you share the same birthday. Last year we went and shot coyotes. We're going to do it again this year. So, looking forward to it.
Andy said no.
Yeah, Andy said, I'm a little bitch and can't go.
I was told that I am not going to be getting out of the planter before then, so.
Buy a bigger planter. I mean, I don't see the issue. I saw one the other day. It looked like it was about 100 yards long, wide. I was like, yeah, that'll do it.
So, check them out, huntworthgear.com. Use code MWW15 for 15% off. Black Ovis. Actually, today I'm going to post a picture of our buddy Pat. He got some
arrows made.
He sent it to me, and then I didn't save the picture, so I had to ask for it again.
That custom arrow builder program. I don't know if that's what it's called or not, but they have a pretty sweet program to literally custom build you arrows.
Yeah, you pretty much all you need to want and need to know, I think you just need to know the length of your actual arrow, and then you can go in and customize what brand, how many fletchings, how you want to do a left, right helical, whatever. Yep. So get them custom made.
And don't lie about the length, guys. Okay.
This is one that's, really matters.
It matters.
Yeah.
Half a pack of Rolaids is perfectly fine. Use the code. Use the code MWW10 for 10% off. Also, Camo Fire, sister company of theirs. We're not going to talk about what they got today because it's going to
be
gone by now.
Way gone.
But it's a daily flash sale. If you don't know what it is, you can download the app.
If you're listening to the podcast on Tuesday, it's Trail Cam Tuesday.
That's true. You keep saying that.
Is that accurate?
It is. Every
Tuesday. So if I got on there right now.
We're recording this on a Tuesday.
This is a Tuesday, yes.
Yeah. So let's confirm Andy's, because you've said that a few times and you might be lying.
Nope.
That is definitely not cameras. Yeah. That is all hats, knives, some pants.
They changed it up on me.
Andy's full of crap.
Andy is
I'm confirming
dumbass.
Ooh, I want that hoodie. That's nice.
Yeah.
That's a good one. But yeah.
Typically.
We haven't done Trail Cam Tuesday in 10 years, you dumb shit.
I thought it was Trail Cam Tuesdays.
Isn't that just a hashtag you use? So check them out, camofire.com. You can also download the app. I haven't downloaded the app back to my phone since I had to clean it out, but
that tripod's pretty sick.
Yeah.
Man, they always got some good stuff.
Yep.
Anyway. I said we weren't going to go through the damn site today. Sorry. Anyway, Alps Outdoors. I don't know what else to say.
The Grand Slam Turkey Chair, my best pack, favorite pack I have.
For turkey hunting?
Period.
No doubt.
Kyle,
I had
turkey.
The Enforcer, which is the same thing you've got for coyotes. We've talked about
just
that.
I have a little different.
Turkey pouch, like a vest.
Yeah, and
bag.
I just got a bag.
And you have a backpack. Yeah. It's like zipper style.
But they both have the same like kickstand, whatever you call it, chair in it. Well,
I've taken so many naps this turkey season.
That's what, dude, it's been great for turkey. And hopefully Friday when you and I potentially do it, I'll be doing it, using it again because it's turkey hunting. I have really enjoyed that.
You have to wake me up because I kick those legs back and
you just fall asleep.
Start snoozing.
Yeah. Use the code WOODSWATER, all spelled out, for 30% off anything. And then finally, Zamberland boots. Been using the hell out of them. You know, it takes about, I would say, 24 hours to break your boots in, like a day of use.
Yeah.
If that.
You know.
Yeah. And the more you wear them, the more comfortable they get.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I got mine on right now. I wear them for work.
They're awesome. Literally do. Yep. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right now, dude. I'm telling you, they're perfect. Especially now, it's been raining. It was raining all day yesterday. All the grass is wet.
What are waterproof. What are those ones that you have called that we all have them?
The
Celates.
Celates?
I don't care. Whatever they're called. Celates. I wore those on the farm. I wore those. I wore them everywhere.
Yeah.
It's not like one of their like main hunting boots. But these Celates, dude, they're like an everyday wear.
They're going to Colorado with me.
Absolutely. Oh, for sure.
They're definitely my backups.
Yeah.
Dude, they're not going to give you the ankle support, obviously. No, they're low tops. But they're my...
I wear them every day at the farm. I love them.
Yep. They're great. So...
So appreciate all our sponsors and friends of the show for being a friend of the show.
Yeah,
being our friends. Thank you for being a friend.
Let's not do that.
This is the Missouri Woods and Water Podcast.
Can I not keep
going? No, we're
done.
Push the button. Okay, with us today, we have Cade Mastis with Maven. Cade, what's going on,
man? How you guys doing?
Doing good.
I think Mike and I are both doing better than Andy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That ain't too bad. Today wasn't a bad day. It's still coming.
Andy came running in here from the dentist. So, yep. So today, like people have already heard on our intro, we're going to be talking about the basics of rifle scopes. But before we do, Cade, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us about Maven a little bit.
Sure. So my name is Cade Mastis. I'm one of the three owners of Maven, and I oversee the operations department, all of the purchasing, inventory, shipping, et cetera. I have a staff under me doing that. And then I'm also the product manager for rifle scopes and rangefinders.
Okay.
And then my business partner, Mike, he is the product manager for the spotting scopes and binoculars. So kind of split it, split it up a little bit so no one's too overwhelmed. And then our third partner, Brendan, he's in charge of, you know, the design, the marketing, and those aspects of the business as well. So between the three of us, we pretty much will oversee all aspects of the business. We started in mid-2013, took about a year to develop our first products and get things off the ground, and launched our first product in July of 2014. And, you know, just been kind of eking things out since then, kind of growing slowly and organically. You know, we started out with two binoculars, the B1 and the B2.
Okay.
We have a pretty simple naming convention. We come out with a product. It's either a B or an RS for rifle scope or RF for rangefinder. And then just in the order that we release them is the number that's attached to them.
Keeps it simple.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, we don't spend a lot of time on product naming. I will say that right now it's kind of sometimes simplicity bites you in the butt, right? So we just revised our B1, and it was different enough that it needed its own number because we wanted to show it was new and improved, but it's also the foundation of the line, so we didn't want to make it the B7. So now we have the B1.2,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the end, no one really cares. Keeping our naming convention, at least where you can tell the series, the class of product by the name, helps. You know, when you have all these different birds or reptiles or cities or mountain ranges naming your product, you really don't have anything to, no one can say, oh, I have the, you know, the Wyoming line. I'm like, ooh, Wyoming, that's awesome. You know, who knows where it would fit. At least we can say, you know, all of our B are our premium, all of our C is our classic line, our mid-range line, and that's true across the board of all of our products. And so that kind of helps us internally keep things a little simpler.
No doubt.
But I digress, sorry.
So
that happens. You're going to see me in the weeds quite frequently.
Oh, no, that's all right. We like being in the weeds. So did you guys... Have you always been in the optic field, I guess, or did y'all just y'all saw a need and a want and just started, or how did that how did it come about?
So kind of a quick backstory on the three of us. All three of us worked at an outdoor company previously. We worked for a company called Brunton that was based out of Riverton, Wyoming, about 30 miles away. And all of us were in kind of the product development side there. And they went through this huge international, they were owned by an international corporation. That international corporation was bought by another big international corporation. And they were starting to kind of break the company up, and they wanted us to move to Portland under one of their other big brands. And we didn't really have an interest in that. So we actually left in late 08, and which is a terrible time to start.
Yeah, that was a bad anything. Time. Yeah.
It was pretty terrible timing. And we started a product development company where we basically did contract product development for independent retailers. And we ran that through the end of 2013. The problem we were finding there was we didn't have anything to really sell. Like, we weren't building anything. We were helping other people with their brands. We were helping people increase their revenues at their storefront. But our company, really, it was just a service company for the three of us. So we were sitting around with some friends of ours that own one of the biggest binocular factories in the world in Japan. And we've been friends with them for 20 years and literally sitting around the campfire, having a couple of whiskeys. And they were like, well, we've always wanted to come up with a product. We wanted to develop a top tier binocular out of Japan that would compete at any level in the world. But right now, none of our customers are really interested in that. They all come over and they want to compete at the mid-range. They want to compete a little bit cheaper. They're trying to fit a certain sales slot in a major chain's optics cabinet, and there's not a whole lot of room at the top, so they wanted to compete in the middle.
Yeah.
Like, well, that's interesting. We'd really like to take a product like that, a top-tier, you know, world-class product out of Japan, opportunity to work with friends, people we like. And, you know, right around that time, Kuyu was really making some hay with their direct to consumer in the premium clothing side. Like, you know what, there's an opportunity here. If that with the direct consumer, we can put something out that's absolutely world class and do it at a price that's half of the competitors and fill a unique niche to the consumer. So that's what we did. And it took a little while to get off the ground, and, you know, we've just been releasing new products as they come up. The other cool thing about being a direct consumer company is we're not locked into this release cycle of the major brands.
Yeah.
Typically everything's shown at SHOT for the shooting sports, and everything's shown at Outdoor Retailer for the green sports. And so you're on the same product development cycle as every other company in the world. The factories are backlogged during those windows. And for us, as soon as something's ready, we can sell it.
Yeah.
So if we miss a January launch, we can launch it in February. We can launch it in March. We don't have to wait a whole nother year to get it in front of people. So that's been interesting. It's been good. It lets us continue to talk about new stuff throughout the year.
Yeah.
You know, launched our C-Series rifle scopes.
Yep.
January 3rd, like just completely out of cycle of what you would expect. And they're doing well.
So I know we're going to talk about rifle scopes, but this is intriguing to me because all three of us actually learned about Maven through my brother-in-law. Another shout out to the gear guy.
Surprise listeners. Russell.
Hey, Russ, what's up, man? When I was looking at putting a new rifle scope on a gun, I had a rifle scope that I was not happy with. I won't mention the brand, but was not a fan of it. Never have been a fan of it. And I'm like, you know, what should I get? Obviously there's brands that everybody knows the name, but he knows everything. Like that kid knows everything. He knows every little thing about every product. He does research. He does a lot of research. So I'm like, what should I get? I don't want to spend $17,000 on a scope, but I want a good scope. I don't want garbage anymore. And the first thing he said was, you should look at Maven then.
Yep.
And I'm like, who? And he said, Maven, you should look at them. And so I got on your website, and the kind of the rest is history with all that. So what are some of the positives you just mentioned, being direct to consumer? You can kind of control your own timeline, I guess.
Sure.
Some of the struggles with being direct to consumer is you don't have, you know, you're not in front of people's faces as much, like at, you know, a store front, that sort of stuff, where they can actually see it. What are some of the downsides to being direct to consumer like that?
So that's a mixed bag, honestly. The not being in front of people, we go to a lot of shows. We mm-hmm. go to a lot of shows. But they're all consumer shows, and every yeah. conversation is with an actual user who might actually pick that up and walk.
Yeah.
When we were in the wholesale side of the business, every conversation, like when we'd go do SHOT Show, it revolved around 17 meetings. The entire year went around 17 meetings. And if one of the buyers from the big Nebraska chain store came in and made a good purchase, everyone was dancing. If they were disappointed, you were not.
Right.
But his purchasing cycle is different. What they're interested in, like I kind of alluded to earlier, they have a $2,000 slot and it's filled by company A. They have a $1,500 slot, company B, whatever, all the way down the chain. When they come into your meeting, they're like, I have a $750 spot. What do you have? Like, well, I have this $1,000 one. I have this $500 one. They're like, all right, take the $1,000 one, strip it down to where it's $750, and we'll take $10,000 of it.
No.
I had meetings where those guys wouldn't even look through a product. They would just tell what slot you had to hit dollar-wise.
Yeah.
So, you know, the disadvantage of direct-to-consumer is every conversation is one sale. They're not walking out with a container load of product. The upside is every conversation is one sale. So if I blow it, I haven't lost my year.
Right.
You know, you'll always have that chance to get them back. But the truth is we're talking to the end user, the guy, the gal that really, they have an honest question about that rifle scope, not because they think they can sell it to 20 million more people, but because it's their own personal use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So most of our product development comes from these shows where we're talking to a customer and they're like, man, this would be perfect if it only had A. What I'm really missing is B.
Yeah.
And we jot those things down. We make a note. And when we've heard the same thing 20 times over a course of a couple of shows, we're like, there's our next product.
Yep. Yeah.
So it's real world, real time feedback is awesome. You know, the other advantage, I think, of not being in those big box stores is I'm not relying on a 17-year-old college or high school kid who's working weekends that got a free hat from one of the other companies, and now he's a lifelong fan, so that's all he's pushing.
Hats are cool, though, I would say.
I'm sure you've experienced it. You've gone into a store and said, hey, I'm looking for a product, and they're like, oh, this is the one you want.
Yeah.
Well, the secret is that there's companies out there that are directly compensating those guys 10% of the purchase price of whatever they sell to buy their own gear later. That's what they're going to pimp. And so we're able to go out, talk our own product with our own people. And we're never going to be the 1,000-pound gorilla because direct to consumer is by its very nature a smaller market. But everyone that we get to deal with are real users, real customers that are giving us real feedback on product. And I think that's pretty cool.
And I think that's what's got to be cool about it is, you were kind of talking about it a second ago, that $750 slot, right? Every product that you guys make is, not to be weird about it, but kind of one of your babies, right? Like you took people's feedback and then you said, we're going to create this. And then you have a meeting and say, well, this is a $1,000 scope. And that buyer might say, well, we need it for $750. And take all this crap that you spent a lot of time on off of it and then sell it for that. And it, you know, it doesn't feel like your baby anymore when you have to do all these changes. So it's kind of interesting that, or cool that you can kind of create what you want based on obviously what your customers want in the end too. Let's jump into rifle scopes, and we'll probably touch on rangefinders and stuff like that, binos too, at some point, because we're all excited to try that rangefinder.
Yeah. Dude, you need.
Yeah, especially which one are you using? The garbage one that
mine.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
That thing might go to like 200 yards before it starts having problems.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Rangefinders are fun, but yeah, we'll jump right into rifle scopes, and then we'll kind of see where it goes from there. So, rifle scopes are the bread and butter of the optics industry, and you figure 80% of all optic cells, I believe, are rifle scopes in it.
Oh, really?
At first you go like, ooh, that seems bizarre. But you go out and you get your first nice pair of binoculars, you probably don't need another pair.
So you're going to hang on to them for a while.
What's that?
You're going to hang on to them for a while. You're not going to.
Yeah. And they serve multiple purposes. Every time you go deer hunting, every time you go antelope hunting, if you're going to go turkey hunting, you can use that same pair of binoculars.
Yeah.
You might add an 18. You might have an 18 power, you might throw a compact into the truck, but really for most users, a binocular is one and done. But you need a scope for every gun you have. And, you know, when you're 18, 20, 25, you probably have your one do all gun, but as all of us know, gear creep happens.
Yeah.
You get a good deal. You win one at the wild turkey banquet. You inherit one from your dad, whatever.
You just go spend $5,000 in a month, period.
Yeah.
Like me.
Yeah. So, you know, you walk back here into the gun safe, and I've probably got 17 rifles in there. Most of them have scopes on them. I'm still waiting to mount up a couple because I'm behind, but I'm just not going to take a scope off one gun, put on the other. Yeah. I need it sighted in, ready to go, so I can grab and go to the range tomorrow. So, rifle scopes are a very, very broad category. And because of all of the calibers, all of the different style of hunting, all the different styles of shooting, that also translates to a broad range of needs in scopes. So you go back to, you know, the 1800s when they basically just put a glass tube in with one lens and a crosshair. And it hardly magnified at all, but it was a really nice addition, you know, much more precise than iron sights. And then people started adding more and more lenses and doing what they needed to do to make them a little bit more precise and more durable. Then, you know, my history of scopes isn't awesome, but, you know, when I was hunting with my dad, we had, you know, the fixed six power. Sometime in the late 80s, everybody started to come out with the 3-9x40. That was the bread and butter for rifle scopes. And it's still our number one asked for rifle scope. Where's your 3-9x40? It's like, well, we don't make that, but we also don't use a Betamax for to watch our shows. It had its time, but it's been surpassed. But anyway,
there's better things out there now, guys.
Yeah,
it's over there with your A-track.
It just makes me think of somebody I know's cell phone that still uses the old flip.
Oh, boy.
You know, like, hey, you know it's 2022, right? Like, yeah. Your phone can do a lot more than that.
So when we first set out to design our first rifle scope, the RS1, surprisingly enough, we spent a lot of time kind of polling the community. And for us, we're a small company. I mean, the product development dollars literally come out of our pockets. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not this big corporation where we can draw from, you know, years and years of proceeds. It's, you know, nip and tuck. And so we have to be smart about it. And so we knew we had to kind of come out with a do-all scope to start. And we didn't want to come out with a 3-9x40. We wanted to come out with something that was within that all-around hunter, but covering the low end by going a little bit lower and the high end by going a little higher. So the RS1 is a 2.5-15x44.
That's what I got.
So you're on a, you know, 30 mil tube, so you get some extra adjustment in it. You're going below the 3 on the low end for people that want to use you know, down in the timber and the brush. And then I actually use it on a 22 rimfire because it has the parallax adjustment, goes down to, you know, 10 yards so I can shoot indoor matches with it. And then top end up to 15, I can shoot steel out to 1,100 yards pretty easily on my bigger guns. Then, of course, there was the two great debates. exposed versus cap turrets, mm-hmm. and first versus second focal plane. And I'm not positive we got it right in both instances, but we also knew we had room to grow. The first focal plane was a big debate because all of us are a little bit older and grew up hunting these, you know, second focal plane or non-zoomed reticles. So we had to ask around a lot. What we heard is the market's still probably 50-50, maybe even more 60-40 towards second focal plane. Mm-hmm. But the higher end is all first focal plane, the wave of the future. So we jumped on the first focal plane and we're really glad we did. We did go with cap turrets because of the just general brush hunting aspect of life. This wasn't designed to be a long range scope or a competitive scope, but we did work with a company, Wyoming Arms, to make some custom drop in turrets that you can put on, get cut free of ballistics. So it does have the ability to retrofit. And it's been a workhorse scope. I've shot elk and antelope and rabbits and a lot of steel and paper with it on all kinds of different guns, everything, you know, from my little 22 to a 300 Win Mag. And it stood up to it. So it was a really logical first scope to me. It'll probably be in our line for a long time. I think we will work on some variations of it, some enhancements to it, or at least, you know, keep it as it is, but then have some sub models here in the near future, we're hoping. But at the same time, we started developing our second scope, our RS2, and it was purpose built by me because I was selfish and was unhappy with the options I had for my new gun. We just had a friend of ours in Vermont build us this ultralight backcountry 6.5 Creedmoor for elk hunting. I didn't want to put an RS1 on it. RS1 added, you know, it's a 23.5 ounce scope, and I wanted a dual scope that was in that 12 ounce range.
Okay.
I'm only shooting this gun, you know, 400 yards at an animal. It doesn't have to be tactile turrets. It doesn't have to be, you know, this super long range scope, but why would you build a 5 pound gun and put a 2 pound scope on it? So we developed the ultralight scope and sat down with our manufacturers to kind of be a little bit more cutting edge on some of the materials we used inside the turrets. You know, brass is great, but it's dense. It's a little heavier, but we didn't want to use aluminum because aluminum does catastrophic failure. So we did some hybrid materials in there and just kind of worked to push the boundaries of it. And I'm not going to go detail of all the scopes we've done, but that's been our progression. Is we created a project, or, you know, we found a need, did a project to fulfill that need. Almost immediately that generated another need, like, okay, now you've filled this gap. Here's the next gap. And here's the next gap. I will talk about the RS3 and 4 combined because I think it's a fun conversation. We knew after the RS1 and 2 that that was the limit of our internal abilities to really, you know, push the boundaries. And so we gathered together a group of hunters and shooters from across the country, all that had ties to us in one way or another. So they were all friends. We could kind of bring them in, but we flew or drove them all to Lander. And we did a 3-day round table sitting in our old building, and we did a day of talking. And then we went out to the range for a day. Everybody brought their guns. We bought a pallet of ammo. We shot everything from, you know, P90, full auto, and SCAR 17s up to, I mean, just pretty much well any gun you could imagine. We had a couple of our gun partners send us some T&E guns to play with. And I think we probably had 40 or 50 long guns out there that we just played with all day. And everyone brought the scopes that they liked and what they used and what they used on different things. And we kind of used what we had talked about that first day. And then, oh, you know, here's that scope I was telling you about that has the first focal plane. Here's a reticle I really like. Here's one I don't like. We walked through that. And then day three, back to the drawing board, spent another full day in the office, kind of putting, starting to draw our overlapping circles. And we realized that we had to develop two rifle scopes to meet everybody's needs around the table. So the RS3 and the RS4 built off the same concept from the same group of people. The lightest long range hunter on the market, the RS3, it's a 5-30 that weighs like under 30 ounces. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing.
That's oh, it's both yeah, of it's, you have. Yeah, right? Both have the RS3 yeah. and me and Mike's awesome. Too. Awesome.
Yep. Right? You know, and people complain a little bit about the zero stop because it's an old school zero stop, but it's the single lightest zero stop that you can do. And you know, there's no illumination because illumination adds weight. And not every state allows illumination.
Right.
There's still some that's considered artificial light. We don't have the, especially at that time, didn't have the skew capabilities of diversifying our minimums too much, right? Like that's mm-hmm. a lot of buy-in. But then we developed the RS4 at the same time, which I call the kitchen sink scope. It's got everything. You know, 5 settings of red illumination, 5 settings of green illumination, full cap turrets, 34mm tube. Weight was not an issue there. And we launched them almost simultaneously. But both of those came from that round table of users that are competitive shooters, professional guides, a former optics counter manager at a big box store, kind of the works. Mm-hmm. And that was a fun project. And I still tap into those guys a couple of times a year. We're all part of an email chain, and every rifle scope we're coming out with, I shoot to them and say, what do you guys think about this? What's our miss here? What are we doing there?
Yeah.
It's good to have that research group for sure.
Yep.
Yeah. And so, they're actual users. So.
Yeah. So as it relates to, you know, kind of talked about some of the different scopes and that you guys have. And I think it's important for our listeners, like we were talking, Andy actually was the first one of us three to do this. And a lot, I think, of our listeners are interested or curious as to what they should do or if they should make the change, but the difference between first focal plane and second focal plane.
I mean, up until like a year and a half ago, I didn't know there was such a thing or like even what it was. I was still grabbing my dad's gun out of the case. And it was the 3x9, you know, first or second focal plane,
yeah,
40mm tube type stuff. And until we got into coyote hunting real big and starting to, you know, shoot a little more distance, figuring that out. My buddy Calder turned me on to a first focal plane and said, you need to check this out. And that's when I started. So, yeah, like Nate said, kind of explain to people the differences, because I'm sure you're going to have a way better explanation of it than we are.
I'm actually going to start one step before that. And I always try to do this on any of the optics podcasts or any of the forums and stuff that I do, because you'll be amazed at how many people out there don't even understand what the numbers on a scope mean, let alone when we start getting into the intricacies. So
yeah,
I've had guides and outfitters come up and say, I don't understand what the 10X means. So I'm going to start there. So the numbers, when we talk about any optic, the first number is the magnification times your eye, or it makes it that much bigger. So a 10X makes it 10 times closer, 3 times makes it 3 times closer. And in a rifle scope in particular, because it zooms, it has variable, what we call variable optic, variable zoom on it. The first number is the low, like a 2.5 to 15 means it goes from 2.5 times magnification to a 15 times magnification, and everywhere in between. There are some brands that just have like it's 2, 4, 6, 8, and it doesn't have indents, but most are zoomed throughout. Then the second number is the size of the objective lens, or the lens pointed at the object, in millimeters. So that's probably the most misunderstood, or the least understood, however you want to look at it, number in an optic. I'll have someone come up and they'll pick up my little 30mm B3 and go, I really like this size, but I want it in a 56. Like, well, that's not how it works. The 30 dictates the size. Oh, but I like this small size, but my friends tell me I need a 56. So if you can take this 30 and make it a 56 without making it any bigger, it will be perfect. So we spend a lot of time describing them. Well, what those numbers really combine to mean is, you know, most people confuse the size of the objective lens with field of view, mm-hmm. and field of view is rarely indicated by the lens. It's the entire system. The longer the optic is, the smaller the field of view is going to be, just by naturally necking down that viewpoint. Higher magnification is going to lower your field of view. A bigger objective lens can help, but really the objective lens is all about light. It's like the pupil of your eye, the bigger it is, more light comes in. So the whole thing has to work together end to end in the optical system. And so I wanted to start there, but part of the optical system, right in the center of the scope, and it's floating in there, and it's the part that when you twist your turrets to move the reticle up or down, left or right, as you're adjusting it, or if you're dialing to shoot, is called the erector tube. And inside that erector tube is a bunch of lenses and your reticle. And depending on where you put the reticle in that erector tube will determine if it's a front or second focal plane. And a lot, the first or front focal literally means that the reticle is in the front of that erector tube. So as you're looking through it and you're looking at all those lenses, it's not only magnifying the image downrange, it's magnifying the reticle. Hmm. So as you change the zoom, it zooms the image and the reticle at the exact same rate. If it's in the back, if it's a rear or second focal plane, it's behind the zoom mechanism. So as you change the size of the image, the reticle doesn't zoom because it's behind that zoom lens. So that's the nuts and bolts of how it works. Why it works is, you know, a little bit more esoteric. And if you have a ballistic compensating reticle, a BDC, or, you know, anything with the dots and lines on it that shows you where to hold over, mm-hmm. in a second focal plane, that is only accurate at one power. So those lines
a single power, correct? Not
a single, one, a single fixed power. Right. So, for example, on our CRS that we came out with that goes 3-12, the holdover lines inside are 5, 10, and 20 MOA at 12 power. But as you decrease the magnification, the image gets smaller, but your reference on those hash marks stays the same. So as the image gets smaller, the point of reference where those hash marks hit the body of the animal or the lines on the target get further and further apart on the target. So at 12, it's 5 MOA. At 6, it's 10 MOA. It's exactly double.
I was going to ask what it is. Exact number, if it was a, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's because the, you know, if you use the magnification, there's always an X there. Mm-hmm. You can think of it as times. 12 times magnification, 6 times magnification, 6 is half of 12. Therefore, it's doubling that distance or halving the magnification in between. So if you're out in the field, and you're walking along and you're kind of down in the timber, and let's say you know that you're 308 drops 5.5 MOA at 400 yards. So right at that hash mark, that first hash mark, if you're on max power, that's your holdover for 400. Mm-hmm. Well, only if you're on max power, but let's say you've been walking through the trees, and so now you've got it sitting down on 4 power in order to have a better sight picture if you have to do a quick shot.
Right.
You take a shot, you wound the animal, it runs out in a field and it's 400 yards away heading for private property. Now you've got to take a shot to try and put it down, right, to finish your harvest. You take that, you hold it over at that 5 mark, but you don't adjust your power, you're off by 20 feet. You're nowhere close to it.
Is that bad?
Yeah, it's not ideal.
It's not ideal.
So a lot of things have to align if you're going to hold over mm-hmm. and use a second focal plane reticle. Now, 90% of animals or something like that are shot between 1 and 300 yards. You're not holding over. It doesn't matter. Use what's comfortable to you.
Mm-hmm.
But as people are starting to push the limits of, you know, back when I started hunting with my dad, a 400 yard shot was just not even, it wasn't in the books. Now it's, you know, now people are pushing it, you know, double, triple that on a regular basis. And there's kind of two schools of thought, and they're a diverging school of thought in most areas. And it's the holdover versus the dial.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to hold over, a first focal plane is almost mandatory.
Right.
Because those markings are only going to be accurate at one setting on a single setting on a second focal plane. So you're always having to make sure you're at that setting or doing math, calculating all the changes all the time. The other group is the dial. I call them the spin to win crew. And it's a very robust and growing area of the industry. I tend to see it more in shooters versus hunters, mm-hmm. but that is also changing. And we're also starting to see a lot of people that might never use it, but feel like that is the hallmark of a scope is can they dial it? So we have a lot of long range hunters and shooters but still like the second focal plane because they don't want to have to look at anything different.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as they're dialing, they're not really using the holdovers in there. And I have people that still want an old fashioned duplex reticle in a 24 power scope because they're never going to use any of the marks other than the dial. And then you have the hybrids, which most people fall in the hybrid in my experience. My very limited experience where they dial elevation and they hold wind.
Mm-hmm.
So you're starting to see reticles with a lot more bars on the horizontal vertice, mm-hmm. but a cleaner up and down, and they're dialing that piece. So that's really where you start to get into the differences of use. It was interesting, you know, here in the US, we do a lot of shows. And you can pretty much well divide the groups as they walk up. You can kind of guess who's who.
Yeah.
But I just came back from a show in South Africa and exactly zero interest in a second focal plane reticle. They've been using first focal planes for years, and it doesn't matter if they're shooting bush pigs off their porch or if they're shooting the King of 2 Mile down at Cape Town, they are only using first focal plane across the board, period.
Hmm.
I mean, so it does seem to be adopted a lot more overseas. France was the same way.
We're late to the party, like a lot of times.
What I like about those on the first focal plane is it's math. No matter what, you know, power you're at, it's math for your rifle. I mean, if you can do math in your head pretty quick, you can figure out and you can get close to whatever you're shooting at, I feel like. But after talking to a lot of people, I talked to a guy the other day, he shoots quite a bit of long range. I'm like, oh, first focal plane? He's like, nope, second. I can't stand first. I'm like, seriously? He's like, yeah, it just gets in my head. I can't, you know, I'm second focal plane. And like so many people, it's just personal preference, it seems like. But,
and I don't know where I'll lie. I mean, the idea, because I now have a first focal plane scope, but I don't have enough experience with it yet to know how much I like it. The initial thought as to why I made that choice was I really like the idea that no matter what power I've got that scope on, because the three of us we've gotten pretty heavy into coyote hunting. So sometimes that shot, you don't have like all day to turn it to 12 power or, you know.
You don't know if that coyote's coming in at 20 yards or 400 yards.
Mm-hmm. Not always.
You want to be able to make the adjustment quick.
So my idea is, you know, if I have that rifle so dialed in that I know, you know, and I'm just going to be very rudimentary with what I'm saying, the second hash mark down is 350 yards and 500 yards is the fifth one down or whatever, right? Yep. I know that no matter where I have that scope, that is what it is.
Yep.
That's the idea. Now, I never really had issues with second focal plane other than the fact that if you had your basic duplex reticle, like you were saying, I hated holding 8.5 inches high where I was aiming at air at that point, essentially on, you know, like an animal, right, like a coyote, you're aiming at air above its body. That in my brain, that doesn't work well. Like, what am I aiming at? There's nothing there. Yeah. So it always would mess with me. So that's my goal with the first focal is, I think if you get really dialed in with your rifle, you should know every little hash mark, every little thing, like you kind of do on yours now.
It's getting better.
It's, you know, this is what it is at this amount or this yardage.
Right.
That's our idea and why we decided to switch to a first focal plane. And I don't know if I'll be one of those dudes that will use both. I mean, I'm sure there's people out there that, hey, I'll have a first focal on this rifle and a second on this one. But that's kinda
how most of us are, honestly. Uh-huh. Most of us have a mix, kind of depending on the application. And as we come out with new scopes, things continue to change. We also have access to more scopes than most people. We could probably play around a little bit more than most, but nothing replaces trigger time. Doesn't matter if you're going to use a first focal plane, a second focal plane, and all of those things are only good if you have certain key pieces of information. If you don't know your ballistics and don't know your drops and don't know what your gun does, right, it doesn't matter what your scope is. Doesn't matter if you're going back and forth from factory loads to hand loads to what you found up on the floor of your pickup truck on the way out hunting.
That's me.
Doesn't matter.
Again, it doesn't matter. Those scope, those marks aren't going to do you a lick of good. And conversely, if you're going to shoot your animals between 100 and 300 all day, sight in at 200, leave it on mid power. Don't worry about what scope it is. Just get really, really good at pulling a crisp, clean trigger.
Which, you know, honestly is really, I mean, think about it. It's a lot of hunters.
Yeah.
Even coyote hunters out west. Sure, out west, compared to where we are, longer shots are more possible. We're in farm country, but, you know, there's quite a bit of timber. So I would say 300 yards is probably one of your longer shots. I mean, you could probably go out there a little further. Out west, yeah, you could shoot 500-600 yards. But how often are you actually doing that? Probably not too terribly often.
Now, the difference between 400 and 600 yards for me, the number one area where that comes into effect is antelope hunting. We have these big open rolling sagebrush hills. And I swear every antelope out here carries a rangefinder. And he knows exactly what your comfort range is and stays about 50 yards past that. So all the little guys, they get into 200, 250 all day. You can clobber them. You know, you can have your tag filled and be back at the house by 10 if you want. But if you want a big guy, you either have to be super sneaky, which I'm a big guy, I'm not that sneaky, or you need to add another 50, 100 yards to your shot. But it's got to be good, clean, ethical shot. It's not a, I think I can wing it because I did it once on a still plate. You got to go out and know the ballistics of your gun and practice. You know, I use an app called iStreetLock or StreetLock Pro that you put your ballistics in and you can do it. He says write it down.
Yeah, write that down.
Mike is writing it down.
What was it called again?
StreetLock. So on the Google store, which I use, it's called StreetLock Pro. On the Apple, it's called iStreetLock, I believe.
So go ahead and write iStreetLock. Yeah.
But it has almost every reticle in it. And you enter your ballistics, you use your, it'll actually enter your temperature and all that stuff based off of weather apps. And it'll give you your ballistics for your round for that day where you are.
Wow.
And if, you know, it's, I use this as a example all the time. We live in Wyoming. Elk season and antelope season overlap. I can wake up in the morning at 10,000 feet elevation and hunt elk for a couple hours and then drive 20 miles and hunt antelope at 6,500 feet elevation at 80 degrees with the same gun. And those ballistics are significantly different in what the bullet's going to do. And so throw it in a good app like StreetLock. Enter your information and say, okay, now on my reticle, my fifth line down is my holdover for 400 instead of my sixth line down or seventh line.
Right.
Which is the difference between gut shooting an animal and one and done, which is all of our goal, I think. So,
yeah, and I think that's maybe the biggest hurdle people have to – maybe I'm wrong. I'm just – maybe it's my biggest hurdle. But I think most of our audience is probably similar to us. You know, they may or may not be serious about certain types of hunting, and they're real serious about others. And as we've gotten more into coyote hunting, we've gotten more into guns, which is where I made the joke about spending thousands of dollars over the past 6 weeks, which is true, by the way.
I wouldn't advertise that one.
tap my wife's patience on that one. That has been the biggest thing I've had to decide with scopes is first focal versus second. There's positives to both. You know, like the one negative I will say on my first focal plane scope is that 2.5 power, that thing is tiny. You know, that reticle is small. Now, I haven't seen it out on a target yet in the field to know how much that will affect me. It probably won't at all. But compared to that second focal plane that I'm used to, that thing's the same size, right? You went through the science on that.
Aim small, miss small,
but right. So,
yep.
I think I'm gonna like that change, but it's just a matter of knowing the difference. I mean, for years, none of us knew what the hell that meant. First focal plane, what the hell does that mean? Just go buy a scope from the store and move on with your life. And it just so happened everything we've ever had is second. So that's a cool explanation of those two differences.
And I think you'll like it. I mean, the odds of you actually walking through looking for coyote, deer, elk, anything like that at 2.5 power is almost non-existent. I mean, there's a reason the fixed six was the number one scope for so long. It's a great walking around power. But if you're down in the thick black timber, a 2.5 with just some basic black line references, you're going to see a lot of fur on that animal because it's going to be close enough you could probably poke it with the barrel.
Yeah.
And so that's the concept, is to get everything out of your way except that kind of center that references thing.
Yeah.
If you have to take a snapshot per se. So
let's also talk about eye relief. For me, it's been it's probably has a lot to do with the way you mount the scope, which we'll, you know, maybe even get into some of that. But one thing I will give Maven a huge attaboy on is there's been some other scopes that I haven't owned, but I maybe looked through that. Let's say the power goes up to 24 to 36. I don't know, just, you know, really high, right? But when it's up there, all I'm looking through is like a little pinhole. You know, I can't see anything I'm actually trying to look at. As opposed to my Maven, the first time I put it at 15, which is what mine is, all I do is stick my eye down there and I can see everything. What goes into getting good eye relief? Is it more about your tube diameter and your optical objective lens, or is it more about the way it's installed on the rifle?
So it's a little bit of both and a lot of neither. So really kind of where it starts is it starts with the eye box. So basically that set of lenses closest to you,
mm-hmm.
where the zoom mechanism and all that stuff exists, that's a really big piece of where eye relief itself comes through. But one of the things you were mentioning about the kind of pinhole, that's actually a function of exit pupil, which is one of those terms, you know, when you're talking about all the different specs, exit pupil is one of them. Exit pupil, and it's a lot easier to demonstrate if this were a video, but I'll try and walk through it audibly. Basically, if you hold an optic up to the light, but away from your eye, a binocular, spotting scope, whatever, there's a circle of light inside that optic. And the size of the circle of light is the objective lens divided by the magnification. So if it's a 10 by 42, which is my favorite one to use because the math is easy, that's a 4.2 millimeter exit pupil. But if you do a 10 by 30, it's a 3 millimeter. That means that's the size of light, that's the target area, that your eye has to hit to get a full picture coming out of that optic. So the worse that ratio gets, let's say the RS3 is a great example. It's a 50 mil objective lens and it goes to 30 power. That's what, 1.2 millimeters. Your eye has to be perfectly lined up to get that that little beam of light to deliver.
That full.
So it's less forgiving when you have a bigger, a smaller ratio.
Gotcha.
Eye relief is the distance away from that lens that your eye can be to get a good focus. On a binocular where you're putting it right to your face, they're usually 15 to 18 millimeters. That accounts for people who have, you know, more prominent brows that keep the binoculars out, or myself where I wear glasses, I can leave the caps twisted in, put them right up, and I have that natural 18 millimeter gap in between there. On a rifle scope, if your eye's right on that, you're going to join the half moon club as soon as you pull the trigger. And so you have to be a little bit further back to get that eye relief. And, you know, one of the most common things, if you have a miss setting, is you get vignetting. You end up with some black shadows around the edge. And first you have to have a scope that has good eye relief. You know, ours are, you know, 2.5 inches on almost all of our scopes, plus or minus, which gives you room to get comfortably into the stock, but not get your eye punched out when you pull the trigger. But mounting on a scope is one of the most common mistakes made by shooters. And I get as many messed up scopes back from people who have had gunsmiths mount them as people that have mounted them themselves. So it's not just the amateur at home. There is a fundamental misunderstanding. They're mounting them too high and then they can't get a good cheek weld. They're using rings they already have that are too short, and then they don't clear the bolt, and so then they move the scope up to clear the bolt instead of, you've got it, all the pieces have to work together. It's like baking a perfect cake. If one ingredient's off, the whole thing ends up tasting terrible. And so you have to use a good quality rings. Don't go out and spend $1,000 on a scope and then cheap out on rings. Good bases, good materials. And then, you know, there are a dozen good videos out there on how to properly mount a scope and how to get it set for you. But you know, one of the best things I heard, I think I can walk through it audibly, but basically you get a scope kind of soft mounted in some rings, mm-hmm. and you close your eyes, you bring the gun stock up to your shoulder and open your eye. And if the scope isn't where it should be feeling comfortable, move the scope. And you should do that 3 times in a row after moving it to make sure that when you bring it up, it's in a natural position. And if it's too high, too low, too far forward, make the adjustment you need to, because you need to be a good shooter. You need the natural position on the gun. And then you should move the scope around that, not your positioning around the gun or the scope. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. So I already got to change stuff.
Yeah.
I remember going backwards with my my butt pad so that I got better relief through the scope.
Oh.
So yeah. I changed so that I could.
Yeah.
That's good. Good idea.
So, and then I think, you know, kind of lastly on that aspect of it without getting too deep is use a torque wrench on mounting your scope. If you don't use a torque wrench, you do not have a properly mounted scope.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thin aluminum tube that can easily be distorted by overpressure. Most rings are not designed to touch when they're closed.
Mm-hmm.
So we use worn rings here for everything. And, you know, they're not cheap. They're about $170 a set. But when you're mounting an $1,800 scope.
Right.
You know, might as well spend the money.
10% of the cost. 10%
right? of your scope. And yeah.
And they are, when they're torqued correctly to 18 foot-pound or inch-pounds, they do not touch. So if you are just, you know, at home and you've just got a star wrench and you're like, I'm just going to tighten it down until they touch and I'm good, you have now pinched that scope. And where you pinch it is where the erector tube is. And that erector tube is what moves your reticle around. And so you can crack a tube. You can pinch it And then when you let off the pressure, it goes right back to normal. But if your scope's not tracking anyone's brand, if your scope's not tracking or it's an erratic placement, 99.9% of the time, it's a mistorqued, mismounted scope.
Really?
Do you use Loctite?
Now, if it's a $50 scope, it's the scope issue. Use blue Loctite on the bases. I use no Loctite on the rings.
No Loctite on the rings.
Blue Loctite on the bases, no on the rings. Okay.
It's a, I don't think it's a hard and fast rule. I change out rings and scopes often enough that I don't like to have it too gummed up, but I clean off my screws. I've never noticed grease on the worn screws, but I have on some other brands. I do Loctite the bases, and those get, I think, 60 inch pounds. And so they got to be torqued down a little bit more. And those things, you'll almost never, ever take them off again.
Yeah.
But when the scope in the rings, I've never had one come loose. I always have a torque wrench, so I can always check them if I'm worried. If you're one and done mounting it and you think you're never going to move it, I don't think there's any harm in throwing a little blue Loctite on it, but
yeah, take it from me, listener, rings are important.
Yeah.
And listen to what Kay just said, because this was years ago. Russell will remember this story. I got my first deer rifle. It was grandpa's the one I was
300 Win Mag. Yeah.
And, it just came with cheap. It had a scope on it and I didn't know anything about it. And I'm like, hey, this will work. We went to shooting, and after about, you know, five shots, I thought I was on. So we started shot a little more, and I got worse and worse and worse. And after a while, Russell looks at the gun. He's like, oh, no wonder. The scope had totally come loose and was like laying on one side almost, you know, and had moved all the way back or forward, whichever way the gun would make that thing go, just without us noticing years ago. And it was because it had cheap-ass, you know, $25 rings on it from who knows when. And that was the first lesson I learned. Rings are important. So now I usually spend quite a bit on rings.
Even if you get a cheap scope, which, I mean, I don't suggest it, but it's what holds the scope in its place. So you need it to be quality, you know, if you think about it. So bad rings will make any scope turn bad. So
what's some other good tools for installate? Like when you install a scope, you know, you want to level it, obviously. So what's some other tools that you like to use with installation? Obviously a torque wrench, you said that. And then how do you like to go about leveling your scope? How do you process that?
Pretty simple process, and not to overly plug ourselves, but we do have some good mounting videos and some, I did a YouTube on the Maven site a couple months ago about the difference between first and focal plane, the quick little 2-minute video that's worth mentioning. But so I have a bench vise. Can't remember the name of it. You know, it's a portable bench vise that I can pop a gun in. And then I have a set of Wheeler levels. And they're really slick because it's a 2-piece kit. You put, you know, first you find level on the gun.
Mm-hmm.
And then you use the second one. It mounts on the barrel so that they match. Then when you take off the one that's from your flat part of the gun, after you mount your rings and you put your scope on it, you go back to, you put the small one back on top of the scope and you just make sure that it marries up to the one that's on the barrel. So you always have the two references of level.
Yeah.
We've used a reticle leveler before too, the kind you clip onto the barrel and then look through and get the visual. But as soon as I went to the 2-level system, I've never had one twisted. Don't be afraid to remount a scope. A lot of the rings that are ring and base combos, they can go both directions. They can mount, they've got basically L-shaped feet on them. And if you're going to mount it far forward, you put both facing forward and that gives you a little bit more play that way. If you've got like a smaller person or a youth gun, you might flip them both the other direction. You can flip those back and forth depending on the scope. Some scopes have a smaller mounting platform, like the RS3 is a good example. The forward mounting section is much smaller than the rear mounting section. So you might want to flip that front one around a little bit to give you a little bit more room to to manipulate. But I see people go, ah, screw it, I've already made it this far, I'll make it work. But it's a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of things invested to not go back and do it right.
Yeah. So, okay, so
play with it. Do
explain,
it right.
Explain that again, because you use the same thing that I do. So you put the gun in the vise. You put you mount the level on the barrel.
No, so I put the gun in the vise, and every gun has a flat spot on it.
Right.
Right. And then I put the magneted one on that flat spot until I level the gun in the vise. Once I know it's leveled in the vise, then I put the barrel mount on and match it up so that they're both in agreement.
Mm-hmm.
That way I can take off the other magnet now and start working where the scope is, knowing that I'm holding my level. Then once I get everything mounted up and soft tighten the screws, then I can put the small level back on the top,
on the
cap
top of the rifle scope. Okay.
And use it to level and match up. And even though the wheelers are really precise or fairly precise, there is a little bit of a play. So I always line up on one edge of the line or the other, because it's just enough that if you try and center it within the bubble, there's some, usually about a half millimeter float on each end. But if you line up right on the, like a left bubble or right bubble perfectly, you can get it super precise.
Hmm. Huh. Nice little trick there.
Yeah, that's a good idea. What are some, are there any other tools that you would recommend for the basic person to have if they're going to install a scope?
So I would say one of the more controversial discussions I had with the round table, you know, we were trying to build our perfect setup. I'm like, all right, what is the best bore sighting tool that there is out there? What do you use to bore sight? They said, the vise. You pull out your gun, you pull out the bolt, you look down the barrel, you line it up at 100 yards. Don't put a laser in there. Don't try and fiddle with any of the extra tools. Literally bore sight it, looking down the barrel, and then line it up to the gun. And I ended up getting a clamp for my tripod so that I can clamp it in there and aim down the alley, which makes my neighbors a little bit nervous. And I have a spot about 100 yards down where I can see one of those telephone top transformers. You know, on a line, and look out there and line it up and click it. And I'm usually on paper when I get out to the range. It doesn't take a whole big kit to do things right.
Right.
You know, back a few years ago, lapping rings was a big deal.
Yes.
I don't know if you guys are familiar, you know, really gritting up this tube and lapping rings to get them lined up. The new precision manufacturing, I'll probably get eviscerated for this by this high precision guys, but I've never lapped a ring in my life. And with the quality stuff that's coming out right now, it seems to be consistent enough to not need it. I'm sure if I was a world-class competitive shooter trying to shoot at the 2 mile mark, that precision might matter, but so far I haven't had an issue. Did have one really interesting issue though, and it's worth noting. Had a customer just absolutely could not get their scope to dial. Could not. They kept bottoming out. They were on a 20 MOA rail. Turns out that the manufacturer had put in one medium and one high ring in their package.
Huh. Oh, wow.
And pretty high to match up when you've got two different heights of rings in there.
Yeah. Jeez.
Bad luck on that guy.
And I've got another one. This is going to sound stupid, but I am terrified to touch my lenses. And when they're dirty,
that's a good question.
I will put off cleaning them because I don't want to scratch them up. What do you like for cleaning lenses? Is there a certain, like, I see these lens cleaner pins, or, you know, obviously everybody's got sunglasses and the sunglass cloth. What do you like for cleaning your glass?
I lick them.
Literally.
Wow. Okay. We got a glass liquor.
He was stone-faced when he said that.
I was like, this guy's serious.
Window
so
liquor.
Anything that's approved for eyeglasses is good on binocular lenses and rifle scope lenses. The thing that always causes the damage is the grit before you get them cleaned. And that's why the lens pens with the little brushes and stuff are so popular. Because the first time you put a little piece of sand on there and you don't see it, it doesn't matter how great your cloth is. If you use that cloth to push a piece of sand across your lens, you have a scratch. So a little dust of air. I actually recommend water. Like our binoculars, what we tell you to do, or, you know, it's a little harder with a rifle scope because you got to manipulate around the gun, but they're sealed. They're waterproof. They're designed to take some water on them. Mm-hmm. We recommend you rinse it with warm water, get it nice and make sure that there's no debris on it before you ever touch it with a cloth. Then you can spray it with, you know, any of the lens cleaning stuff. Don't use glass cleaner, like commercial glass cleaner removes coatings. Oh. So you don't want to do that.
Don't use Windex.
Anything you got to get from an optometrist for eyeglasses, anything you get, you know, from like our lens cleaning kit has a spray in it from a brand called Equity, I think. Purity. Purity lens cleaner. And that's when I go get my glasses at the optometrist, they give me a bottle of the same stuff. So it's pretty common. And then a nice microfiber cloth or 100% cotton cloth to get rid of the streaks. But it's better to have a big old smudge in the field that you have to clean later than it is to have a big old scratch right down the middle. So if you're not sure you've got the dust off of it, don't touch it.
See, though, that's perfect for the people like me out there listening that
lick it.
Dude, I'm serious. I might have to. You see me out there spitting on my gun.
Or maybe just take the bottle of water out and pour a little bit on there first.
You know? Yeah. Because I will let it get dirty because I'm just like, I'm not going to touch a damn thing. I don't know how to clean it. I want to screw it up.
Yeah.
I've probably been doing it wrong.
Yeah, I actually scratched my – I didn't follow my own advice, and I scratched my glasses turkey hunting this weekend.
Uh-oh.
The only cloth I had on me, I was wearing a synthetic top layer. My daughter's hunting with me, the 11-year-old, and she sees me go to do that. And she goes, Dad, is that 100% cotton? She just got glasses and mom's been drilling it into her. I'm like, no, it's going to be fine. And what did I do? Put a scratch right up my lens.
Oh, of course. Man. Do as I say, as I do.
Did y'all have any luck?
Yeah. So my daughter's 11. This was her first time going turkey hunting, and she killed a nice tom on Saturday morning. So
that's awesome.
Friday morning.
Congrats. I'm assuming
52 yard shot with a 20 gauge.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
I'm assuming a Merriam out there.
Yeah, I've actually got a picture off to the Game and Fish for review because it's pretty bronze tipped. Okay. We usually get some pretty crispy white tails out here, Merriams, which is nice. But yeah, this has a little bronze in it. I think it might be a hybrid Rio, but
nice.
Nice, real nice bird. She killed the biggest bird of the weekend.
There you go.
So she's been rubbing that in.
Got some bragging rights, huh?
Well, tell her congrats for us.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Yeah, sure will. Now she's getting geared up for antelope season. It's her first year being able to big game hunt.
Oh, that's cool.
She turns 12 this fall. So
awesome.
She's all in.
That's awesome. Yeah, Wyoming has some of the fun stuff out there.
Yep.
Hopefully she can get a good scope on our gun.
Yeah, maybe probably take care of it.
I'm sure she's covered.
So, you know, for the listeners, obviously Cade, you know, is part owner of Maven. He's partial to his brand. We all use Maven. So, you know, we thought it was natural to talk to Cade or you all about the basics of rifle scopes. And I'm sure there's stuff we didn't get into.
A lot of stuff.
You know, this was a 30,000 foot view for people who just want to maybe learn a little more before they go buy something.
Sure.
We're not talking to professional shooters in this show. But for those folks, let them know how they can get a hold of Maven and look at your stuff and how they can go about
buying since you are direct to consumer, can't find them at
big box
stores.
Go to Bass Pro or something. Yeah,
find them.
Yeah, mavenbuilt.com is our website, spelled just like it sounds. And, you know, all of our stuff's on there. We have a lot of different There's some different tabs that have the specs on it. There's some stories about our products on there. So yeah, that's really kind of the one-stop shopping. We're pretty active on social media, so you can get on Instagram or Facebook at Maven Built as well. And then we do have a YouTube channel. We primarily use our YouTube channel for educational stuff. We have stuff we call the Maven Minute. So there's one you should watch. There's a 1 minute Maven Minute on how to clean your optics.
I will.
You know, there's how to mount a rifle scope and how binoculars work and what the numbers mean. And, you know, nice little snippets of, you don't have to embarrass yourself in front of your friends not knowing something. You can go on there and become a quick expert. So
nice.
Highly recommend it.
And speaking of binoculars, you guys just got another award from Outdoor Life, didn't you?
For best overall hunting binocular for 2022, the B1.2.
Yeah.
I know. I love mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're by far the best glass I've looked through, for sure.
That's pretty awesome.
Looks like we have a natural timer on our.
We do again. Yeah, this is pissing me off. Zoom. I'm going to have to look into this because this is a first for us. Zoom is
limiting our time here.
Yeah, which we don't pay for a pro account, but we've never had to worry about it. So we'll figure that out. But there was one more thing I was going to say. Oh, whoever came up with your guys' logo back in 2014. You got to give them a high five because you guys have a badass logo. I'm just saying.
That's
your
Brandon.
Hat.
That's
your hat's one of my favorite ones.
Yep. Good deal.
Huge fan.
Well, Kate,
thanks for having me on. Glad we got a chance to chat. Hope we checked off your list there. But yeah, if anyone has any more questions after this, our primary customer service gal Molly, she's a competitive shooter and she probably kills more big stuff than the rest of us combined. And she also loves to chat. So give her a call and, ask her some questions. She'll love it.
Awesome, no Kate. Well, thanks for hopping on with us.
We appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. So you're going to stick with the first focal plane?
Oh, yeah. Well, I haven't even used the damn gun yet.
I say it's kind of, yeah.
But I'm excited to use it.
You really need to shoot it because you got a few extra guns that we've talked about that you haven't got scopes for yet. So you kind of need to decide on what you're going to like.
Like we talked about in the intro, if you and I go to do our second annual coyote hunt up north, I don't currently have a coyote gun.
I mean, I got one, but I need to take my new one.
Dialed in.
Yeah, same. Well, shoot, man. It's like we turned into Kansas or something like that. It's been windy every damn day.
That is no joke.
It's getting ridiculous.
So it's either windy or raining.
Yeah.
Or I've been on a tractor. So if I can get a good day to shoot, I'm busy. And you guys are too, because there haven't been good days. So anytime the sun's shining... I know Nate's got ball tournaments with his kids every time.
Mike has got family kids.
Stuff. You got
Did
farm.
I say that out loud?
And my issue is, I don't have. I could
you have
shoot
to
at
travel
my
travel to a
yeah,
range.
I yeah. could shoot at my house if I want to. I just don't feel. I don't think my neighbors would feel comfortable.
Well, and I'm
with
the same
it.
Way.
And I so I just don't prefer to do that.
Yeah, I do my shooting somewhere else, even though I probably could
shoot
here.
My deck.
Yeah, exactly.
Which you have no issue.
Yeah, you're lucky in that fact.
Me, it's probably not a thing. Because I've got multiple hills between me and
if I were you, I would have no problem shooting.
See, I don't.
So I've been fortunate the last couple of years. I planted I did some dirt work stuff. So I went beans on beans at my house. So I've been able to shoot.
Beans on beans on beans.
That's not a thing.
That's not
a thing. Oh, okay.
St. Taco Bell. But I've been able to shoot all year round.
Yeah.
Well, I planted corn this year.
Oh, so you're kind of limited.
Unless I decide just to mow a trail to my range. I hate to say that, but it's crossed my mind a time.
Can you not just plant, you know, one, like, get you, well, the way you probably set it up, you can't get a road where you just don't plant
well,
one.
Well, it'd be downhill and then the water. And
did you leave that edge again this year? Or did you plant it?
You have enough room.
Nice.
You're welcome.
I mean, if we ever get around to planting anything. Yeah. We never did last year either.
Yeah. No, we'll get that taken care of, but... I'm hoping I need to get shooting now just in case I can't. I'm going to have to elevate some targets. I mean, because I'd still have a good backstop right there.
Oh, yeah.
We need to find an evening where we just do it because it's staying light later.
Yeah. No, there's definitely enough time in the day to shoot at the end of the day. But like we all talked about before, he's either planting, you got some type of practice. Same here, Lawson, he's got practice or games. So
you're starting the old T-ball circuit.
Yeah, it's actually coach pitch.
Oh,
yeah.
Snap.
He's 4 years old. This is his first.
Straight to it.
Yeah, he went straight. It's some friends of ours that are coaches because it's not even in our school district. Not that it really matters. So, you know, some friends of ours, they wanted him on the team. They just, you know, they saw the natural athletic abilities from their father, and they were like, we need him. So
that kid has to play for us.
Yeah, exactly.
He's going to be a stud, or he's going to murder somebody with a bat. One of the two.
No, he's a sweetheart of a kid. He just, he likes to joke around a little bit. He's a jokester.
Love the kid.
Yeah, he's awesome. So, but thank you, Maven, for coming on, you know, kind of giving us an overview of how some scopes are put together and what you need to think about going into, you know.
Yeah, when you're purchasing one, and this isn't even, like, don't think this was a commercial for Maven, because it wasn't, but that is the basics that you need to think about when you're going to purchase one. We have all owned and own multiple brands.
Right.
There's all kinds of good brands out there.
Yeah.
Maven is definitely one of them. And what I like about Maven, just to stay on that topic for a second, being direct to consumer, I can get a scope or a set of glass that is high end
for
not necessarily that price, because, you know, it's not going through like a store or whatever at the same time. So that's nice.
It's top of the line glass is what you're looking at. Whenever you go look at Maven stuff,
we didn't even talk about like where the glass comes from and all that.
Right,
stuff.
He kind of did a little bit. It comes from Japan. If you do any bit
itself,
yeah, the glass itself. If you do any bit of research, Japan makes the absolute best glass you can get. So, you know, there's that.
It's pretty solid. Pretty solid.
I wouldn't, maybe not like the best. It's right up there with the best.
It's high quality.
No, I'm pretty confident.
That's some high quality H2O.
Pretty confident it's the best. But anyways,
hey, water boy.
All right.
Oh, you know what? I heard of it. I need to talk.
Something's wrong with your medulla oblongata.
He does it.
For beginning of the show, we talked about you know, our friend Dustin there. I've been thinking of a question I need to ask him. And I heard, and it's not, I don't know, it could be true. Bees are allergic to pollen.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. How you figure that?
They break out in hives.
They break out in hives. My brother's going to enjoy that joke.
I'll call your brother.
He's going to enjoy that joke. I don't know if he listens or not. But
that was a joke?
I'm joking. They laugh at D's nuts. No, Captain Insano.
Why are you? Get out of here.
No, Colonel Sanders. You're wrong. Mama's right. I'm going to go watch that movie now.
I don't need you to push the button.
Yep.
No. You can't tell me what to do. Are we done?
Yep, we're done.
I wasn't really listening. Did you do a dad joke? Oh, man. I was thinking about
you're on, you're on something
he's
today,
a
aren't you?
Slow, isn't he?
Yeah, something. Yeah.
You'll have to forgive my friend.
Bees aren't really
he's a little
to pollen.
Slow.
Okay.
The town is 2 miles that way. What movie?
This episode
is
over.
Like
a Gone in 60 Seconds DVD. It was here a minute ago.
This isn't even late at night.
Have a good one, guys.
Later.
See ya.